Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So who was Susan Frances Gurley, and why is this chair in theoretical physics and biology named after her? This is her picture up here. But for myself and a number of you in the audience, she was our mother, our wife, our sister, or our grandmother, who passed away 12 years ago. But beyond that, she was a major force in getting her children interested in science, nature, and for me, in biology. Susan loved children, and especially babies. She had six children of her own, worked as an obstetrics nurse in the local hospitals delivering babies, taught an infant care class for people who were having their first baby, and kept an ever-expanding menagerie of animals in the backyard, including at one point over 100 rabbits. So as far as biology was concerned, she was definitely focused on the reproductive aspects. Now, my dad worked as an engineer, so you might think that us kids picked up an interest in technical things from him, especially since he was constantly rebuilding the engine to the family VW van. He worked on stuff which seemed pretty cool to 10-year-old me, nuclear submarines, Mariner spacecraft, power plants, all this stuff. But what he actually did was just incomprehensible to me. He would sometimes bring home blueprints covered with these mysterious squiggly symbols and lines everywhere. And I completely failed to figure out what this stuff had anything to do with submarines or Mars rockets. So engineering was definitely out as far as I was concerned. But one day, we were living in Boston at the time, my dad decided to take a night course in molecular biology at Harvard. Unfortunately, the squiggly symbols and lines used in molecular biology were completely different from those in engineering, and he decided the course was not for him. So my mother, Susan, took the class instead, and she aced it. Needless to say, she was very pleased with herself and started taking courses in genetics. And if anyone has taken a course in genetics, they know that there are lots of fruit flies involved. Fruit flies breed like, well, flies. And you can watch the genetic changes from one generation to the next quite quickly. Well, soon enough, I had these vials of fruit flies in my room. Flies with red eyes, black eyes, albinos, striped bodies, you name it. And bugs were something, as a 10-year-old boy, I could understand. And my mom carefully explained to me how these genetic changes all worked, and I was fascinated with this. And eventually, she even had me reading her textbooks. So I decided I was definitely going to become a biologist. Well, long story short, what I actually became was an engineer. Passing through physics along the way. Yes, I became one of those people making diagrams full of mysterious squiggly symbols and lines, just like my dad. So there must be some genetics involved, since three of my siblings became engineers as well. And I guess the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. Nevertheless, I have never lost my fascination with things biological and try to keep up with the latest goings-on. And I blame this lifelong fascination on Susan F. Gurley, who put so much energy into instilling a curiosity about nature and science into her children. So, Mom, this chair in theoretical biophysics is entirely your fault. Now, it is my privilege to introduce Boris Schramm, who will be the first inhabitant of the Susan Gurley chair. As David said, Boris worked previously in the field of condensed matter physics, where he made a number of important fundamental contributions. He is currently making important contributions in his current line of research in theoretical biophysics, and I think Boris is the perfect fit for the Susan Gurley chair. There are many reasons why, but let me give you one of them. When Boris sits in on a talk, He is that annoying guy sitting in the back of the room who asks the really dumb questions. But then it sinks in that the question wasn't so dumb after all, but actually quite insightful. Theoretical biophysics is a relatively new field, and there are a great many really dumb questions really just begging to be asked. And on that note, I will finish so that Boris can tell you about some of these exciting things he's working on.
Susan Gurley Chair in Theoretical Physics and Biology. But this one has Boris Schreiman's name. This doesn't have the name. So this is for...
No, but now you have to see whether it fits.
Yeah. This is for you.
You know, there were many good words said here already and said very well. And I just want to thank our chancellor for his unflagging support to you know, for this institution. And I want to thank David for his visionary leadership. And you know, in David's world, knowledge has no bounds and the science has no boundaries. I want to thank my colleagues at the Institute and the colleagues in the department, colleagues in the university, who share this vision of interdisciplinary science. And I want to, I haven't had a chance to meet Dr. Ehlings before, but thank you very much for helping us celebrate Gus. And of course, I really want to thank Gus, not only for what he had done for the university and the Institute and what he's doing for the Institute, but also for the friendship and the camaraderie that we've developed over the last few years. And it looks like we'll be starting a fly lab together. we were just making some plans. But most of all, even though, as I just discovered, my name is on the chair there and my face is on the program, this chair is not for me, it's for KITP. And it's really very important because it establishes a tradition of interdisciplinarity at this institute. It establishes this broad view of physics, physics without boundaries. And this doesn't just have an effect at the institute or the university, for that matter. You know, because of all the programs here and you know, thousands of visitors every year, we can try to diffuse this vision of science, you know, throughout the scientific world. So it's really a tremendous honor for me to be trusted with you know, opportunity and responsibility for developing this thing at the Institute. So, with this said, the subject of my talk is going to be theoretical physics and biology. Many of you, I think, are familiar with this New Yorker cartoon, this view of the world from Manhattan, where, of course, there is a city and then there is the wilderness. And for a theoretical physicist, it would be pretty natural to have a similar view of science. After all, physics is you know, this great metropolis of thought with Cartesian logical layout and you know, streets paved with beautiful ideas, you know, the action principle, universality, symmetry. And then the rest of science, including biology, is this muddy wilderness on the other side, you know, the Jersey side of science, you might say. you know, the most obvious inaccuracy in this picture is that, you know, the divide really should be much wider. So, but then actually, if you leave town, you might encounter a very different landscape of biology. A landscape which is, of course, very different from physics, but a landscape of towering problems and monumental challenges. And I'm going to talk about two problems. One is morphogenesis, which has to do with the development of those flies that Gus was studying. But not only flies. Morphogenesis describes the process of by which information stored in DNA is transformed into actual organisms, into flesh and blood, size and shape of real organism. And another problem we'll talk about is evolution. And evolution is special, has a special status in biology. It has been said that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. So you can think of it as a kind of theory of everything in biology. And of course, there are many other profound problems, like understanding the brain. We can't tackle everything today. But as it happens, these three subjects also are the subjects of recent workshops at the Institute. There is one workshop that David already mentioned is going on right now. It has to do with morphodynamics, morphogenesis. We had last fall a workshop on evolution, and a workshop on the brain is coming up, I think, in a year, and the previous one was a year ago. So there are clearly problems to think about, but the big question is there a place for physics, and is there a place for theory in all of this? And, you know, of course there's place for physics, you know, we all know that physics, experimental physics, generates technology, and technology had a tremendous impact on development of biology. And, you know, atomic force microscopes and scanning probes developed, the kind developed by digital instruments are just one example at hand. The question about the role of theory in biology is a more delicate one, but nevertheless, I'll try to convince you that the answer to both of these questions is yes. And moreover, we'll see that physics can show up in places most unexpected. So first, let's look for physics in morphogenesis. The workhorse of developmental biology actually turns out to be a fly, just as Gus said. And this is because it develops very rapidly, in a hurry, in pretty much 2 weeks. And it starts, development, embryonic development starts in an egg. Then basically after 24 hours, the embryo turns into larva, which crawls out and grows. And then it undergoes puperation and through metamorphosis turns into an adult fly. And now we're going to zoom in on the embryonic development right on this stage and look at a movie. So I hope you can see this. What you're looking at is this fly egg full of yolk, and inside there is a fertilized nucleus which is going to start dividing. And, going the wrong way. Okay, so the nucleus inside started dividing, but we can't see daughter nuclei until they come out to the surface of the egg. And very soon they'll arrive on the surface, and then they start dividing, and spreading out over the surface of the embryo, and now you will see these waves of cell division propagating from the poles toward the middle. Here comes another wave. And so now there's been 13 divisions, and the things are coming down a little bit because these nuclei are acquiring a cellular envelope, and this embryo is basically turning into a monolayer of cells. And now these cells start moving about furiously. This is the gastrulation event, the formation of the gut. And there are various folds and furrows formed. This is going to be a head. And this sort of view of morphogenesis was not possible until very recently. And it's thanks to the development of microscopy that we have it now. And as you can see, the amount of information here is incredible. And this movie also presents morphogenesis as essentially a physical process. We saw packing of this disordered lattice of nuclei. We saw waves of division, flow of cells. So this is physics of physical objects. But on the other hand, of course, we know that in development, there is a lot of biochemistry involved, and genes are getting expressed. And in fact, it is also possible these days to track many of these processes dynamically, just like this. And yesterday, we were watching some movies with which were really fantastic. So with all this, so these are physical phenomena, but they address ultimately important biological questions. For example, how do these nuclei and cells know when to stop dividing? How do local interactions between cells will define the morphology of the organism? I could talk about this for a long time, but I want to give you another example of what I call unexpected physics. There is a phenomenon called planar cell polarity. So if you look at the fly wing in the magnifying glass, you will see an array of little hairs. Every cell has a little hair, and all of them are pointed in one direction, point towards the margin. Now, if you now zoom further in, look through a microscope, and do that at early pupil stage, you will see that the patch of tissue that's going to become the wing looks like a layer of cells like that. They're quite disordered. And in the course of 6 hours, these cells suddenly order into a nice, nearly hexagonal lattice. And a little later, some proteins localize on some of cell edges, but not all. And each cell throws out a little prehair, now nicely polarized and pointing the right way. So the question is, what is the origin of this nice orderly polarization of little hairs? The common wisdom is that there is a morphogen gradient. What's a morphogen? So morphogen is some protein which is distributed in a graded fashion across the wing. So there's more of it on one side, less on the other. And then the common wisdom picture is that each cell will detect the local gradient of this morphogen and polarize accordingly. So the only problem with that is that this gradient is rather gentle, and the cells are tiny, so the differences that each cell would have to perceive are very small. And this process, you might expect, is rather noisy, and instead of a nicely ordered polarization, you will end up with a disordered one. So that's one view. But another possibility is that these cells do not act on their own. They interact with each other and tell their neighbors which way they're going to polarize. And then you form whole patches of polarized cells. And in order to globally order them in the wing, all you need to do is sense the direction of this gradient on the scale of this largish cluster. And that would be much easier. And this is exactly the behavior, I could say, physics, associated with ferromagnetism. This is the behavior that we understand very well in physics. So amusingly, there is good evidence that something like that is actually happening in the fly. It is possible to make mutant cells, patches of mutant cells, which are basically deficient for some protein, which is necessary in order to sense this global directional cue. And so the red cells here are mutant, green cells are normal, and if these patches are small, you see the mutation really does not affect the ordering, but if the mutant patch is very large, then what you see is that local order is preserved, but global order is lost. And that's exactly what happens under some circumstances in ferromagnetism. And in physics, one understands this quite well. And you know, we recently worked out a model of this behavior with Yoram Burak, who was a postdoctoral fellow here. But again, I'm not going to tell you any more detail about this. The point really that I wanted to make is that these ideas, physics ideas about magnetism, turned out to be useful in thinking about fly wings, even though there is nothing magnetic about fly wings. So that's what I call unexpected physics. Well, so much for morphogenesis. Let's talk a little bit about evolution. Well, as I already said, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, but it has also been said that you can't understand evolution without understanding how natural selection works in populations and how genes spread in the population. And the spread of genes in the population obviously is related to sex. Less obvious connection is to statistical mechanics. So usually when you think of evolution, you think on a global scale, on a scale of billions of years, when one thinks of a tree of life, and on this tree of life, there are bacteria on one side, you know, plants, insects, and we are very close to frogs. And the important thing about this tree of life is that all that we can observe on this tree are the leaves. And whenever we want to think about, say, a common ancestor of a human and the frog, we have to go to fossil record if we can find one. Then, of course, now it is possible to sequence DNA. It's possible to many genomes already has been sequenced. And that allows us to zoom in on this evolutionary tree and, for example, look at 12 relatives of a fruit fly. So all of these genomes are available. Now, it would be fairly difficult to classify these flies just on the basis of their morphology, but we have whole genomes, and then there are statistical methods to identify which ones are close and which ones are further away, and actually try to infer what the common ancestor was. And so this was, we zoomed in on a tree here, and this evolution occurred on the scale of 40 million years. So, of course, the flies out here are long gone. But evolution can act on a much, much faster time scale, too. AIDS is a chronic disease, and its development over the course of the disease is closely associated with the evolution of the virus in the blood. And, of course, this has been studied very actively, and patients have been tracked over the course of the disease, blood samples taken every 6 months, and all the viruses extracted there were sequenced. So Remarkably, what takes flies, so the diversity of viruses here that they acquired, generated in about 10 years, is comparable to diversity of flies that took them millions of years to acquire. But at the same time, here, every ancestor, every common ancestor, every virus from early samples is sitting in some freezer somewhere. And we have, as a result, not just the observation of the viruses that exist right now, but all the evolutionary history of the virus in that particular patient. So this is an amazing kind of data, which makes possible a completely different approach to a study of evolution. So let's take a dive, and let's think about the dynamics of evolution. Let me start from the beginning with a little primer on elements of evolutionary dynamics. So there are genotypes. So the DNA, as you know, consists of letters, is a sequence of letters, and the sequence then controls the identity and individuality of the organism. So in this case, the organism seems to be giraffe. So if I only knew the organism of choice would have been a bunch of rabbits. So these giraffes are different. They have different height. They have a different pattern on the skin. And these observable features are called phenotypes. So the diversity of the phenotypes, to a large extent, arises from genetic diversity, from variations in the sequence of letters on the genome. And that variation comes from mutations which substitute one letter for another. So that's one mechanism for generating the diversity. Another mechanism is sex, because as you know, in the process of sexual reproduction, two parental chromosomes are recombined to form one, so a chimeric one, in this case is part red, part blue, derived from different parents, actually from different grandparents. But this process of recombination then allows to combinatorially reassort the genetic variation that was due to mutation in the first place. And so as a result of all of this variation, giraffes and other beasties end up with variable phenotypes. And in this case, selection, you would think, acts on the height of the of the animal, right, so that they can eat better and proliferate faster. So as a result of natural selection, genetic variants that are associated with long necks would be selected and would propagate in the population. In the case of HIV, rapid evolution is really a necessity. It is necessary, it is needed to escape the immune system. And in the presence of a drug treatment, it is necessary to evade the drug. So this sequence here corresponds to a sequence of amino acids of a particular protein, the protease, which is a target of a successful drug, protease inhibitor. And normal HIV is susceptible to a drug, but if it acquires a bunch of mutations, and it takes more than one, it takes many mutations, it can become drug resistant. So HIV is notorious for having very high mutation rate. It's 1,000 times higher than what we have. And then, of course, the viral populations are gigantic. So in a single patient, there is a large chance of probing all sorts of combinations of all sorts of genetic variants here and eventually discover this drug-resistant mutant. So we all know about mutations. The viruses mutate fast. What perhaps not all of you know is that they also have sex in the following fashion. So if a given cell happens to be infected by two different viruses, in the process of copying their genetic material, they sometimes make chimeric DNA, which combines DNA from the two types. What happens to a mutation, a beneficial mutation, when it appears in the population? So what we're going to do here is let's represent members of a population along in this vertical column. We'll have population of finite size, and along this axis we'll have time. So this green circle represents an individual or virus that has mutated, and this mutation is beneficial. So now it's going to replicate. It will have high chance to survive in the presence of the drug, for example. It will spread in the population until it takes over the whole population. But we also have to remember that this process is not entirely deterministic. There is an aspect of randomness, especially when the numbers are very small. When we only have one or two mutant individuals in the population, chances are that they'll just get extinct by chance. Now, this is the same picture, but a little more schematic, still the population and time. So let's think of what happens in asexual population. And first, we'll think of a small population mutating not very rapidly. So there is a chance that the mutation will arise at some point, and if it is beneficial, it's going to spread over, take over the whole population, and at some time later, another mutation will come about, and here an individual harboring both mutations will take over the population, and the rate of adaptation in a case like this is just proportional to the rate with which one generates mutations. So the size of the population and the rate of mutations. Now, but suppose now that the population is very large or is mutating very rapidly. So now several mutations, several beneficial mutations might arise before the first one has taken over the population completely, and then these guys will compete with each other. Only one of them can win, and that means that these mutations are wasted. And instead of a rate of evolution being linear in population size and the rate of mutation, it becomes a logarithm, and that's a much smaller number. So the conventional wisdom about the benefit of sex is for the sexual mode of reproduction, there is a chance that if we have several genetic variants in the population at the same time, they might recombine with each other. And the individual incorporating these three mutations will arise much sooner than was the case without sex. So the conventional wisdom is that the rate of adaptation in the presence of sex then goes back to be scaling with population size. We can now try to think about this a little bit more deeply. So suppose we have a population with lots of different mutations and some distribution of fitness. And the new mutation comes in and happens to fall onto an organism which is relatively fit. So it's much fitter than most, and therefore the progeny is going to spread out and multiply and do very well. The only problem is that the rest of the population isn't standing still either. They're also accumulating mutations and getting better. So this whole population shifts, and now a mutated individual now finds itself not at the front, but not at the top, but at the bottom. So instead of spreading through the population, it starts shrinking, and now our new mutation is on the verge of extinction. Now, with sex and recombination, there is a chance that this mutation will recombine with a good genotype and hop to the front of the wave. So this is like surfing. You want to stay on at the front of the wave. And if you fall behind, then you're doomed. There is also a physics way of doing this, turning this into an actual calculation. And you know, physicists like path integrals. So in this case, what we want to do is calculate the non-extinction probability, which is to say the probability of this mutation to survive forever. And in order to calculate this, we have to sum over all possible histories of this process, all possible ways that this mutation has hopped and recombined with different genotypes. So this is the sum over all possible branched paths to survival. And at the end of the day, so this is the calculation we did with Richard Nair and Daniel Fisher, you find that the rate of adaptation doesn't quite go back to a linear function, linear dependence on population size, as conventional wisdom suggested. But it does increase with the increased rate of recombination. So recombination appears to be beneficial after all. And along the way, so I introduced here this non-extinction probability as a computational device, something we had to calculate along the way. But it is actually a very interesting object conceptually, because it's really a generalization of fitness. Fitness is defined as sort of a short-term gain, as probability, basically as the number of surviving offspring in the next generation. But as we know, the short-term gain and long-term survival is not exactly the same thing. So we really want to think, in fact, rethink the whole story in terms of this long-term survival probability rather than fitness. So I just presented you an argument which said that the more recombination, the faster the adaptation. So does this mean that the more recombination, the better? Or is there some cost to recombination? Well, the hidden assumption so far was that fitness is the sum of beneficial mutations, which is to say that the organism works like a gymnastics team. So gymnastics score, as you know, is the sum of individual events. And then if you have a team with world champions in every event, then you can't possibly do better. But an alternative is that it's not at all obvious that an organism is just the sum of its parts. And more like in soccer, success is teamwork. And then what's important is not only how good each individual gene here is, but how well they work together. And the corollary of that is that if you take two teams and recombine them, take half players from one and half players from the other, it's not at all obvious that the new team will be better than an old one, even if you're picking all-stars. So, you know, everybody knows that an all-star team, unless it gets to practice, might well lose to a good club team, right? So what we need to understand is how phenotypes depend on genotypes. Well, one most readily observable phenotype is height. So if we were to take a census of heights in this room, we would probably discover that the height is distributed in a close approximation to a normal, to a bell curve like that. And in fact, it's well documented that the height of an offspring, on average, is equal to the mean of heights of two parents. And about 100 years ago, it was a great puzzle to reconcile the heredity of traits like height and the new theory of genetics, which Mendelian genetics at the time dealt with discrete traits. So, for example, inheritance of blue eyes, right? We all learned about that in high school. But how do we think about inheritance of something like height? So R.A. Fisher made a great step by proposing the following explanation. He said that height receives contribution not from one gene, but from very many genes. And each gene contributes very little. So if each gene occurs in two variants, so genetic variants are called alleles, and one corresponds to a little increase in height and another one to a little decrease in height, in our physics notation, we would represent these genetic variables by a variable plus minus one, and we would write the height as just a sum of all of these contributions. And then there is a well-known mathematical theorem which says that if you have something like this, then statistically it will be distributed according to a Gaussian. So this was a great triumph, and it is still a great triumph, but the question is this the whole story? And the facts are that most traits, most diseases, do not seem to, are not well explained by this Fisher's additive model. And in reality, this genotype to phenotype function is more complex. And instead of using little cartoons in physics, we have a language for describing these additional genetic interactions. And all the physicists in the audience will immediately recognize the situation. All interesting statistical physics starts when we start thinking about the effects of interaction. And the amusing thing is that we can describe these genetic interactions in basically the same language as we do our statistical physics in. So I started this by saying that genetic interactions do not obviously do well with recombination. So let's take a closer look at that. So what we're going to do now is let's consider a bunch of different genotypes. So we create them just by reassorting alleles in all possible combinations, and we'll color code different genotypes and start off population with lots of different genotypes and let them fight each other for survival. And in the absence of recombination, only the population only has the genotypes that we put in. So all that happens is one of those colors that were initially present here will take over the world. So the whole population will be one giant clone. And that, of course, is how we think of asexual reproduction and bacterial populations. On the other hand, If recombination is very frequent, is very fast, then it will be very rapidly breaking up these different genotypes and creating new ones so fast, and in fact so rapidly, that none of them will get a chance to expand and take over. So we'll end up with this genetic soup where every individual is genetically unique. And of course, what we have to understand is how we want to create a map of this phenomenon. We want to see how it depends on parameters, and the relevant parameters are the rate of recombination and the strength of interaction, and we work out what physicists call a phase diagram. That's how you would describe, water and steam. And there are two phases, one phase being this genetic soup phase. And because the genotypes are broken up so rapidly, the selection in the soup phase acts on alleles on their own. So alleles which work well on any background are going to be selected. And for lower rates of recombination, we have the phase where whole teams are selected, the genotypes are selected. And the interactions then preserve certain combinations of alleles which know well to work together. And again, so conventional wisdom, so without considering interaction, would have said that any amount of recombination makes a soup like that. But when you think about interactions, you realize that this transition only occurs at a finite rate of recombination. And this is actually important, because if you now try to measure the success of selection here by asking, what is the fittest organism that was produced in the process? You'll find that the system is most successful at the rate of recombination close to this transition. And this is because, remember, without recombination, the winner was already in the starting set. But when you turn on recombination, you're going to explore this gigantic space of genotypes, and you might find a better one. And typically you do. But if you have too much recombination, you may find a better genotype, but you don't get to keep it. And that accounts for this precipitous decline. So that's what you learn from this exercise, and this is all a theory. And now, of course, we're very eager to connect the theory with experiment, and most importantly, just to rethink the even existing data in light of these ideas. And there is a great deal of data on HIV sequences, the sort that I already described, and the evolution of drug resistance. So what Richard is working very hard on right now is trying to define the model of evolution of drug resistance, just try to understand what the evolutionary landscape is, to what extent this is a soccer team situation or a gymnastics team situation, how important interactions are, and then compare predictions of this model with the observed rate of evolution. And the goal here is, of course, to see if theoretical insight can explain the differences between the efficiencies of different drugs and understand the treatment outcomes between different patients. Another avenue is to actually go ahead and set up laboratory evolution experiments. And another postdoc at the Institute, Pierre Niveau, is pursuing this working with yeast. So yeast is interesting. Now, of course, it's it has a close common ancestor with plants, and like plants, it can propagate by budding or by mating. And the question is there some optimal rate of mating versus budding? And that insight, of course, we hope would carry over to plants. So let me, at the end, return to the question of whether theory can be useful in biology. So this question is often asked, and frankly, I don't understand why. Because the greatest theory, one of the greatest theory of all times, is in the context of biology. And Darwin had it really hard because he had to develop his theory based on very sparse observations, basically fossil record and the observable diversity of species. With all the technology that we have now, we can basically industrialize this process and turn it into a kind of relation between theory and experiment that exists in physics. So it is possible now to do these laboratory experiments. Sequencing and phenotyping is cheap now. And we can then develop a quantitative theory of evolutionary dynamics that would explain the observations, make predictions, and motivate new experiments. And then, of course, these new experiments would prove the theory all wrong. And then the theorists would have to go back and start again. And that's what the virtuous circle of science is. And as I tried to argue here, statistical physics can help us formulate this quantitative theory of evolutionary dynamics. So let me finish with the acknowledgments. It's really been my privilege to work with an amazing group of young scientists, young physicists at the Institute. Richard Nair is responsible for much of that population genetics theory I talked about. Pierre Neveu is working very hard on getting the evolution experiment off the ground. This population genetics work was done also in collaboration with Daniel Fisher at Stanford, and I didn't have a chance to talk about the work of two wonderful students from the physics department. The work of morphogenesis, I don't know if Lars is still here. So Lars is a former postdoc who has crossed the divide and now has his own experimental biology lab. Breeding flies in Heidelberg. And he is developing that fabulous imaging technology, and so dynamic imaging in morphogenesis, and the movie that I showed comes from Lars. And Yoram Barak worked on fly magnetism and moved on to neuroscience after that at Harvard. And I didn't get the chance to talk about the work of Alberto and Kevin. And last but not least, I want to thank Gus for sharing our excitement about science. And I must confess that Gus have already heard much of this story from me before, but in bits and pieces sort of rhythm of tango, two steps forward and three steps back. Every time he stops by after going to a lecture here and he asks, what's up, what's new, he's subjected to some very excited ramble. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.